Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference 2023, April 23rd through the 28th, Nashville, Tennessee. The Gaylord at Opry, what a center, what a place. We have amazing speakers, amazing training, five of the most impactful days of your career. Check it out at streetcop.com. You do not want to miss out. There is a room code available for a discounted room. Sign up now at streetcop.com. 111-110. Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and having me today, a very good friend of mine, one of our instructors, but who also is a undercover guy, here to talk about the day in the life of what he does as a narc. I feel like we're on an episode of like one of those National Geographic things with the garb that you're wearing, but none other than Rios.
Thank you for having me, my brother. Thank you. I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
So let's talk about a few things that I'm interested in. And I know that some of the topics that we're going to discuss are kind of sensitive. So if it's too sensitive, just deflect, pass, and we'll move on to the next topic. But what's a day in the life of a deep undercover narcotic detective like? So, you know, tell me about some of the things that you want to tell me about.
Well, I could tell you that it's definitely tiring. It's a craft. And I tell students that come to the class and they say, oh, I'm interested in undercover work. You have to be truly committed to the undercover life. It's not, I'm going to be an undercover on Monday and then on Tuesday, I'm going to be out and about in my blue line gear, hanging out with my buddies with my badge around my neck. It just doesn't work like that. You also have to understand that it's not just you taking this job title as an undercover, but also your family. It definitely affects your family. So truly understanding and being in the role of an undercover, it's not just doing a 9-to-5 job, it's also, you know, off duty. And what do I mean by that is when I'm out and about, I truly do have to look over my shoulder. I try not to do any kind of undercover operations where I live. And that's also to protect my family. But also have to understand that the world truly is small and you just never know. Have I ever had to experience that? No, thankfully not. But I continue to have those measures to make sure that my family understands the job that I do and the precautions that I have to make. I carry around 3 phones. It sucks. You know, I try to separate everything. It's like a flip of a switch. You go into role and you become that undercover and you come home and you want to flip that switch and just be dad or you know, for others, you want to be that significant other. But if you're a true undercover and, as you say, you're deep undercover, as some will say, the phone can't be off after 5 o'clock. You know, people talk after 5 o'clock. You know, people hit me up at 10 o'clock. Hey, what are you doing? I can't say, hey, I'm off the clock. I'm not being paid right now. Please don't bother me. It doesn't work like that. So, again, if you're truly in that role, it's not just a 9-to-5 job. And you have guys that say, hey, after 5 o'clock, I don't want to be bothered. Or on the weekend, I don't want to be bothered. Undercover life may not be for you because it doesn't stop at 5 o'clock. And you know, you may be very big into social media. You can't have pictures of yourself blasted everywhere. You can't be at a wedding and want to be in every single picture. Facial recognition right now is huge. Mm-hmm. So you have to take all those precautions. And again, it just doesn't affect you. It affects your family. Maybe your significant other isn't down for that. You know what? I can't even be in any pictures with my husband or wife. That's not a life that I want to live. That's a decision that you may have to live with. So it is, it's different. It's very different from being in that uniform that I'm used to. I did that before, you know, and you want to show everybody, hey, look at my uniform. It's nice. It's crisp. It's ironed. And now you live a life where people look at you like there's no way that dude's a cop. Mm-hmm. And it's truly different.
Do you find yourself not wanting to go out more because of the role that you play?
I would say so. I would definitely say so. And it's, and again, it's more of, I'd say, a mix between anxiety, because you have to have a reason, all right? You have to have a reason, like, why are you there? And you may be going out as who you truly are, but if you run into a certain person, you have to flip the script and become that person that that target knows you as. So you could deal with that anxiety level. But also, maybe you can get away with it if you're with your buddies, but being out with your family, once that target sees your family, it just, that's something that can't be undone. So that's why I truly have reservations about going out. And if I do, it's somewhere where I am not even close to being near my targets.
Hmm. Do you have to tell people in your life what you do, especially if you're going out in a public setting? And how many people do you tell?
If I am out with you in a public setting and it's not because of work, then I truly trust you.
Okay.
And that's just the way it is. So yes, if I am out and about, people know what it is that I do, because hey, if I ever just walk away, let me walk away. But yeah, I'm not going out and trying to meet new friends and all that other stuff. It's just, I'm at a point in my life where I don't take unnecessary risks.
Does everyone in your life know what you do? Family, friends, people who at least know you, that know that you're undercover? And do they know the length or extent to which you actually play a role as an undercover?
I would say absolutely not.
Oh, okay.
And they know I do undercover work, and I'd say the family pretty much doesn't want to know what it is that I do. And I think it's better that way. You know, not having those thoughts, I'm assuming, could just lead to anxiety, or he or she is away. So I like to just say, hey, I'm at work, I'm undercover, and I kind of leave it like that. I don't want to say I'm dealing with these kind of people, this is what I'll be doing. I just feel like that brings fear, and I don't want my family to be feeling that when I'm away.
So you would say that you probably have anxiety for the safety of your family to playing this role?
Absolutely. And again, it's the true undercover work. And some people may feel that when they're doing undercover work. And I don't want to minimize anybody's role, but there are undercovers that will do hand-to-hands on a Monday and that's it for the day, and they don't have to play that role again. And then, quote-unquote, the deep undercover, where you're playing that role for months or even years, yeah, that anxiety level is there.
What is the difference between somebody who's deep undercover and maybe somebody who's plain clothes, or I would say a quote-unquote average narcotics officer?
It's actually funny you say that, because in a segment in my course, I go over, like, what is an undercover? And this is just based on my opinion. Whether if you're plain clothes, surveillance, if you are not in the patrol uniform, I feel like you're an undercover. What do I mean by that? Let's say you're sitting on surveillance. You're a regular detective, and you're just sitting on a pharmacy looking for a prescription fraud. And someone comes up and knocks on your window. Excuse me, sir, you've been parked here for 5 hours. What are you doing? Right there and then, you go into an undercover mode. Who are you? Why are you there? Why are you even sitting in a parking lot? You basically have to come up with a story in seconds. That, to me, is you're assuming an undercover role. So while maybe it's a little bit harder for me, because I want to be prepared for bad guys to keep peeling those layers back. You know, what's your name? Where are you from? Who do you know? Where'd you grow up? I feel like surveillance officers, plainclothes guys that are trying to be embedded in a certain environment, also have somewhat of an undercover lifestyle, because you're trying to blend in.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been stopped by the police while playing your role of undercover? Because obviously when you're this deep undercover, there's not deconfliction with everybody in law enforcement. Have you found yourself having to play a role in that sense? And if you were stopped by the police, what are you supposed to do if you get caught doing a drug deal by some inadvertent patrolman?
Have I ever been stopped? No, I have not. But there have been times where I'm in role and I'll have a bad guy with me, a target with me, and, you know, you're driving and you see the cop car in the median, right? And you're like, damn, I would stop me.
Yeah.
So then I'm
if you took street cop training.
Yeah, yeah. If you took street cop, I would definitely stop.
If you went to the police academy and learned how to fire a laser gun at bumpers, you probably wouldn't stop the actual criminals.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that? I mean, you'd be looking for speeders, not actually people committing narcotics transactions of thousands of kilos of cocaine and heroin and methamphetamine. You'd be, you know, worried about Tim who's late to work.
Absolutely.
Yeah, gotcha.
And the truth is, what's funny is that I actually, in that undercover setting, I take the role and I take the anxiety that a true criminal feels when they see a cop car.
No shit.
Yeah, it's like, oh fuck, all right, let me slow down. Let me pull to the right. Like, all the indicators are there. And I'm actually doing them because I feel like I'm in that role of a bad guy, if that makes sense. So, and I'm sitting there thinking of a story, the same thing that a bad guy would. Okay, if this guy stops me, what am I going to say?
Mm-hmm.
And I've experienced that. So while I've never been stopped, I've faced that anxiety level of what happens if I do get stopped, what am I going to say? I look over to my target. Hey, we're going for, you know, we're going to go get some Mickey D's, whatever, but trying to get our stories just in case we do get stopped. But luckily, up until today, that hasn't happened.
You know, it's funny that you bring that up in class. I used to actually don't do too much anymore, but I used to tell people, if you were a criminal, well, I do say it actually, if you were a criminal and you were committing an act, how would you feel if you saw the one thing that you were terrified of the most, which is the police, law enforcement interference with the crime that you're committing? And try to put yourself in those shoes. Matter of fact, practice that while you're off duty. Drive around and say, what would I do if I saw a cop? How would I feel? And try to recognize what that feels like so you know what to look for, because humans are 99% going to have the same reactions, and I leave that other 1% out because there are people who are sociopathic and psychopathic who don't consider law enforcement a threat. And it comes down to three principles of moral, immoral, and psychopathic people. So has it been discussed prior to you going out into the field of like, okay, if we do get stopped, if there is something in the car, am I just going to allow them to arrest me and then explain it later on? How's that going to go? Have you thought about that? Is that something you guys talk about at your office about what to do in that situation?
That's a great question. So with that, usually in all the undercovers that I've done, the consistent answer to that is they're going to allow me to try and talk my way out of it. So I'll get stopped and I'm sure the officer, they're going to have their questions and they are going to allow me to try and get out of it. Now, at any point, if the officer took street cop training, sees the indicators and they're getting me out and they're going to take that next step to, I'm going to search you, search your car, whatever it is, we're going to call a dog. Then at that point, that's when they would come in. Again, that's never happened, but
when you say when they would come in, you would have to reveal it to the police officer?
No, I would never, especially if there's a target there.
Yeah.
It would be essentially my backup team coming in, posing as, oh, we're just here to back you up, but really, hey, this is what's going on.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Okay.
But luckily, again, that's never happened.
So you always have a backup team with you?
Absolutely.
Okay, got it.
In everything that I do, and again, for all the narcotic officers and undercovers that are out there, if you are operating in official capacity, you should 100% have some kind of backup. And I understand that there's some places that you can't, but you should have someone out there.
Mm-hmm. Earlier, you talked about this not being a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday gig. I don't know if you've heard of this before, but there are narcotics divisions throughout this country because of their flexibility to make their own schedules, will work Monday through Thursday and have off on the weekends. Have you ever seen anything like that?
I've heard of it. And the only thing I can say to that is maybe it works for them, but in my experience and my understanding of the narcotic world, they are missing so much.
Right.
And it's true because they look at these criminals, drug trafficking organizations, they also have this mindset that cops work 9-to-5. That's their schedule, 9-to-5. You know, they don't understand, hitting the schedule. They don't understand, you know, the overnight shift. They don't understand that. They're thinking 9 to 5. So when are they going to do these large scale movements? When are they going to do these deals? Hey, cops work Monday through Friday. Let's do it on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Sunday.
Exactly. Cops, hey, when I tell you, I know of organizations that have moved a significant amount of cocaine and heroin on Christmas Eve, Thanksgiving, Super Bowl Sunday. Truth, hand to God. They know these days because if there are cops that are working, they're not searching anybody.
Yeah, they are.
They're not making stops.
Right.
And this is coming from organizations that are telling me this. Hey, this is when we're looking to bring the stuff in. On one of these days. Okay.
You know, Kenny gets a lot of intel from the stops that he makes from the mules that he intercepts and obviously stops from moving large-scale narcotics. There's a lot of interesting things that he comes up with, but sometimes he'll try to get out there on Sunday mornings. I mean, I've literally driven the entire East Coast from Florida up to New Jersey and not seen one cop, especially on a Sunday. And a lot of these guys will tell him, we didn't expect the cops to be out here on a Sunday. I've worked with organizations personally that their narcotics division worked Monday through Thursday. And when I asked the question of why does nobody work Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, it was a comfort thing. They wanted their time off. And I said, you know, drugs move on Friday, Saturday, and Sundays. And what we found out was people knew that. And so they waited till Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, knowing the narcotics division was not in. They'd rather run their chances with patrol division, knowing narcotics wasn't in. One of the most frustrating things for me as a law enforcement or previous law enforcement officer with a brain was that it's permitted that we're all going to take off Monday through Thursday. Plenty of people to be around. You know, I mean, there are people that you and I both know. They work a Monday through Friday schedule. They don't go out on Saturdays and Sundays. And I've been told that organizations know that and they're working around that. So what do you say to something like that? If you're going to take the responsibility, maybe, you know, to take a role like this, comfort's not your top priority. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And you have to understand, the game. And I could tell you that in my career, there have been peaks and valleys. There have been supervisors that have allowed me to work. There have been supervisors that have not allowed me to work. And the only thing I could tell you is you as the hungry patrol guy, interdiction officer, investigator, agent, whatever it is, there are options for you. One, you can decide to pull the trigger and leave, right? Is the grass always greener? No.
If you're standing in the mud, it might be.
Oh, it's very true. Very true.
I mean, you know, it's funny when you see these men and women who are beat to death, essentially, hypothetically speaking. I sit here and I have to wonder why they remain. And there's no question about it. The number one issue is they're scared. But they're no different than like a domestic violence victim, right? Like, you know, as cops, we're like, why doesn't this girl leave this fucking guy, right? Why is she still here? They're scared of what? Probably their own reasons. I don't think anything is consistent across the board, but humans don't like change. And it's fucking wild to me that people will remain in a bad relationships, bad work environments. Sunken costs is a major factor. Why do people stay in a job too long? I already spent this much. I have this much invested in. I already went through this academy. I don't want to do this again. So that's a gift to your former self. Who are you going to be tomorrow? Who are you reinventing? And I have met so many men and women who took that big gulp, jumped, took the leap of faith, and couldn't be happier. And I'm a man who sits here and says to you that if I have lived in my comfort zone, if I had decided to live in my comfort zone, I would not be doing what I'm doing now. And I don't even know what tomorrow brings. But I've gotten so used to following the fear. And I use the example of the conference. So I remember coming home and saying to my significant other at the time, you know, I've said this on the podcast many times. I said, I booked Harris. And she said, what does that mean? I go, for the conference. We're going to do the conference in like 18 months. I go, but I owe them just to start. This wasn't the cost of the conference. This was just to start. The cost of the conference was people don't realize how much that conference costs to put on. It's a lot. I mean, it's well into the six figures, you know, shy of seven, but it's up there. And I said, no matter what happens, I owe Harris $100,000. I signed that contract. 100 grand's got to go to Harris. And she said, well, that's a lot. I said, yeah, it's a lot of money. She goes, what if nobody comes? I go, I've thought of that. And she goes, what do you know about running a conference? And I said to her, what have I known about doing anything? I just jump and grew my wings on the way down. You know, I figure it out. And if you do it the first time, you're like, oh, okay, we know what we're going to do the second time better. And you can just adjust as you go as well. But that was the most significant week of my professional career. I've never experienced anything like it in my life. And you couldn't put a price tag on that. I wish I could live in that week my whole life. I didn't know what it was going to bring for me personally. It was unbelievable. But I could have done what everybody else did and just said, you know what, it's a lot and I'm scared. And what if it doesn't? What if it doesn't work out? You know, I already have, things are going good already. I could just keep doing classes. Like we're comfortable financially. But I can't tell you that, or the amount of, I don't know, personal growth that I received from that, not only business growth, but also personal growth from that event. I guess the point is, I use fear as a compass. And people should not let fear dictate their decisions.
I could not agree with you more. And Dan, you know a little bit about me. Again, I went to your one of your first classes. I jumped ship and I left. Talk about fear. You know, I could see the fear when you're stuck in mud and you just need to get out. I actually left a place that was great to me. It was great. It was a small municipality, a good group of guys. Great environment. You know, the chief now is phenomenal. And I left there, and it wasn't because of the municipality or the guys, but I had a calling for something bigger. And it's not a knock to the agency, but I was...
It's your life, dude, right? It's your life.
I was scared to leave something that was so good and end up going somewhere where I might hate it. So again, I know that fear, and it truly, truly, it takes a lot to take that step. But the only way you're going to find out is if you take it. You know what I mean? So, yeah, again, circling back, what I say to those narcotic officers, detectives, you know, if you can't leave or you decide you don't want to leave, know what you're going through, because in the future, and maybe in the immediate future, you may be in a spot where you can change that. And you want to know that feeling, because there's going to be guys that come up underneath you that say, I want to work on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I want to truly go out and do God's work. You know what? We are going to start working on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But it takes that one guy to truly make that change. And it's narcotics work. Again, if you wanted to be a banker, you know, go to Bank of America. But
right.
You can't say you want to be a narcotic officer. You know, I want to be on a drug task force. But wait, I only want to work Monday through Thursday, 9 to 5. It just, you can't have it both ways.
Right. And you don't got to do it forever, but if you're going to commit to that time period,
yeah.
I went for a temporary run in our narcotics division, and, you know, I knew at day two it wasn't for me. I just knew it. I just liked patrol work, and I liked wearing a uniform. I actually didn't like the way people were treating me. I was going to places that I typically went to go get lunch, and they're treating me like I'm a piece of shit. That happened? Do you feel that happen?
Dan, I've been in places where people knew me. People knew me, right? And I looked a certain type of way, and now I look different. And I've gone to places where I was respected, and because of who I was, and I go back to those same places, and man, I'm looked at different. It's crazy.
The psychology of the human mind is wild, isn't it?
It's crazy. It's crazy. But I understand it. And that's why we harp on people that are, you know, hey, when you're in uniform, it's about presentation, right? It starts off with that first look. Man, that guy is squared away. I'm not fucking with him. The same thing goes with us undercovers. When they look at us, they're like, you know, you can look the part. You could talk the part. There's no way that guy's a cop. It sucks. It sucks, man. I've experienced both sides of it, of being in uniform and being in the UC capacity, undercover capacity, and it's definitely a different feeling.
What is, and this is a question that's interesting, because I remember a story of my old partner who went to narcotics. He's a supervisor now, but he said he went to narcotics school with a guy from a municipality that actually bordered where I was from, and he said, this dude was so undercover that you would have never in a million years known this dude was a fucking cop. And he goes like, dude, he looks like the world's biggest piece of shit. And he's on the job. What is the best undercover besides yourself that you've seen? And you can keep it very vague, but...
I tell you, I have seen probably three guys that I could think of on the top of my head that, you know, even myself, when I looked at them, and I feel like I can pick out a cop, and you get that initial reaction, like, holy shit, he's a cop. And what's funny is that it literally ranges from, you know, a white guy that can't grow a beard for shit, and it's like long and all spaced out, each hair, and he's got a mullet, and he just stinks, he's all musty.
Yeah, yeah.
Playing the role of a user, and you look at him like, man, he's fucking, he's on point, he's an actor. You could truly put him in the inner city, in the housing projects, and he fits the role. So you see that. I've seen a guy that, you know, he's big dude, and he fits right into the inner city, and he plays the part so well. And it's not just looking the part, it's actually when you can look the part, but also when you start talking and you know the lingo.
Yeah, yeah, street code, yeah.
Man, it's just, it's deadly. And you're like looking at it like, there's no way that guy is going to get made. Again, you can look the part, and as soon as you start talking, you're like, all right, this guy is definitely a cop. But when you have those two things, I'm telling you, you become a deadly, deadly weapon. And then I've seen guys that, when I tell you, like, they're wearing these Armani suits that look the part of, like, this dude's got a yacht in Miami. He has to. The way that you walk, you know, you look in, you got the hair slicked back. And it just shows you, it doesn't matter the color of your skin. Whether you're white, brown, black, white, it doesn't matter. Because there truly is a role. If you could speak to it and you know, look the part, but stay within who you are. You know, I'm not going to dress a certain way to try and fit in, because someone that knows what that community looks like, all right, this guy doesn't fit in here. So I don't ever try to be someone that I'm not. Because just like that, and I tell the guys at the academy that are about to graduate, you've been to the academy, right? Imagine me taking someone off the street and I tell them, all right, you're going to be playing a cop right now. You're going to go in there and you're going to try and convince these 60 recruits that you're a cop. After how many minutes, how many questions are you going to be able to say, there's no way that this guy's a fucking cop? Same thing goes into the...
Do you play that game when you go in with them?
Oh, 100%. What I do is I play this game, and I actually do it in my class. And I basically say, okay, I want you guys to tell me if this is true about me or it's not. And I start it up. You know, I do this. This is how long I've been doing it. I get it from here, 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 and here. These are my people that I buy it from. And I go through it all the way down. And I say, okay, sir, ma'am, do you think that's a true story, yes or no? Some people say yes. Some people say no. But it's all about how believable is it. I'm looking at you. Does it seem believable? Same thing. That is what essentially undercover is. Can I have a conversation with somebody and for them to walk away and say, yeah, there's no way that guy's a cop. That guy is a drug dealer. That guy is a realtor. He's this. He's that. Whatever I'm posing to be, that's when you've truly, you know, fine-tuned your undercover craft. If that makes sense. But yeah, it's a different world, man. It definitely is.
When I went into narcotics, many years before that, as I expressed interest in going to narcotics, I like drug game. People are like, yeah, you'll never fit in. Like you look too much like a cop. People who know what I look like, I do look like a cop. I get the haircut, right? I've tried to change the haircut. Like I'm talking about outside of the undercover role. And when I say undercover, dude, I was playing close.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, but I was a good playing close. I had some good guidance on what to look like. I mean, I go out, I've tried to change the haircuts out personally, and this is just the haircut that kind of fits my face and my personality. And it's Jersey, right? Somebody's got a fucking fade.
I like it.
No, I appreciate it. When I went into narcotics, bro, people like literally had no fucking idea. I mean, I really felt like I looked the part. I tried to, you know, do things. And there's a picture around here that's hung. I'm sure you've seen it in the office.
Oh, I definitely.
Yeah, yeah. People had no clue, bro. It was just that easy. They never looked at me and thought I was a cop. And I'll tell you a few of the things that were kind of funny. Here's a good story, undercover one. So I go to a restaurant to eat. So I see this minivan pull up. I see these four guys get out, plain clothes, but like t-shirts, jeans, and running shoes, right? Like t-shirts, jeans, and sneakers. And they're in their like 20s, not dads. So they come into the restaurant. I go, where are you guys on a job at? He's like, we're not on the job. I go, well, now that you know what the, you've responded, but that's what I said. I go, now that you've responded that you know what the job is, and he goes, what makes you think we're on the job? I go, do you think you're undercover? And he's like looking at me. I go, do you think you're undercover? I go, bro, first of all, your boy over there has got that dumb fucking necklace sticking out. I can see that beaded necklace, right? That dumb shit. That one drives me fucking insane. Like, you were undercover. You got the fucking, the quintessential undercover fucking chain on.
Yeah.
Why? Because you want to look like the TV show? Stop.
Training.
Right? Don't get the one from Gauls that they send to you from Gauls magazine, right? Get rid of that shit, right? The Training Day bullshit, right? Secondly, every fucking criminal knows undercover police officers wear tennis shoes, running shoes. I go, you boys should be wearing fucking Tim's or something, like anything else but this. And he's like, well, we work at State Police. So I'm like, no shit, right? You guys are all walking in built like brick shit houses. Try to be undercover. You don't look, I don't know what task force you're on, but like, I could spot you a mile away. I go to the boardwalk. My brother-in-law came recently. So we're on the boardwalk last week with the kids. And I'm like, that's a cop. That guy's a cop. And then I'm like, see that kid coming down the thing? He's a cop. I didn't even know. I didn't recognize him. And he comes over and says, yo, what's up, dude? I'm like, oh, yeah, I know who this is. I called him fucking half a mile down the boardwalk. I saw him coming. I'm like, this dude's a cop. Right? This thing got like sore fucking thumbs.
They do. Especially in the winter. They put the hoodies on. Oh, and it's a wrap.
I don't know. I guess when you're a cop, you can spot a cop.
Yeah.
But I've seen some truly undercover people who look really undercover. Like they do a real nice job.
I'm telling you, when you have the blend of the look and the talk, I think it's the best tool in investigative work.
Have you ever watched any of those National Geographic or Vice Network documentaries on behind the scenes, behind enemy lines, Mariana Van Zeller? Have you seen any of those episodes at all?
No, not really.
It's good stuff to watch. And, you know, it's funny. In class, I diagnose people. I say, listen to me. You know, this is a class. It's 10 hours. I've hopefully changed your life as it's changed thousands of other people's lives and their careers. Humble brag. But outside of here, there's a lot more work to do. You can take training from our dozens of instructors that we have to polish your craft more. You could take training from other companies. But tonight, instead of watching Stranger Things, you can opt to find some of these programs. And there's hundreds of them. Behind the scenes, going into the jungles of these labs and how it works here. Meth, the gun trade, the drug trade, stolen cars, ID fraud, phone scams. Bro, there's probably 300 episodes of all that shit you can watch right now. And Discovery has it and all these things. How to catch a smuggler. And it just blows my mind that people are given the perspective like, well, I want to be a good cop. I want to be a great cop. I'm trying to, well, good, dude. Like, that means becoming obsessed with it. So going home and trying to learn about it. Oddly enough, 2 days ago when my brother-in-law was leaving, because he's on the job in Arizona, I had thrown it on. I saw it. It was Drugs Inc. was on National Geographic. I'm one of those people who actually still has cable. I got it like that. And I was like, you know, I was watching him watch it. He's only a job like, you know, 2 years. And I said, what do you think of these? He goes, these are fucking great. I go, yeah, I tell people to watch it. I tell people, you want to learn more? You don't know hot dick about fucking crime, how criminal organizations work, nothing about this. But you go to work every day trying to figure it out when all the fucking answers are right here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Either informants or those documentaries where they're laying it out, all out. I think it's hilarious.
So the other people in my household were like, how do they convince these people to just talk? One way we were watching was actually one done in New Jersey. One shot right in Plainfield, New Jersey. It was a heroin one in Staten Island. And the other one's buying coke in New York and how they're doing it. The fucking 3-4 cars they go in across the bridges and what time of days they're doing it and what they're looking for, where the lookouts are. You know, they have all the unmarked cars in their district of the Bronx. They go and sit and watch the precincts. They sit there and watch the guys come out of the fucking precincts, and they have the cars written down. They're looking for those cars on roofs. And you know, you get these guys going to narcotics divisions like, oh, let me go buy drugs. Like, you know nothing about the goddamn game to start. I'm not saying I do. I'm just saying it's out there, man. You want to fucking learn about this stuff. Great. I'm glad you're here at Street Cop Training. But like, if you have more interest, go elsewhere. I mean, I listen to podcasts. business ones, but I go to many of them. I buy different. I have like 28 books I've bought in the past like 3 weeks that I'm going to get to, because there's a different flavor for each thing that I'm trying to do and understanding how to make a better difference in this world.
And it's in everything that we do, constantly learning, bettering your craft. It's the truth.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's when you do things and make mistakes. Have you made mistakes undercover?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, tell me about, like, without being too sensitive, what's a mistake that you could share with everybody that you did?
And it's not just, you know, even in my class, like, it's not just undercovers, but it's also investigative-based. You know, I truly believe that the best undercover is a case agent, and the best case agent is an undercover. So I made mistakes both on the case agent side and the undercover. I'd say probably one of the biggest mistakes, and again, I cover it in my class, and I actually do like a little debrief of how it affected me, both on the job and personally. But when I first started doing undercover work, I was the yes man. It didn't matter how crazy the job sounded, I was doing it. Whatever it was, I was doing it. And what do I mean by that is, you know, think about, as an analogy, I'm not saying it is the job, but just think about, you know, this type of job. Let's say they tell you, okay, we're looking for an undercover, and we believe, you know, the kingpin, the head honcho, the head of the drug trafficking organization is at this strip club, right? So now imagine it. They call you, the case agent calls you and says, I want you to be undercover for this. Okay, what's the job? We're gonna give you money, you're gonna go to this strip club, and we want you to try and buy weed. Now with that, it's undercover, strip club, buying weight, count me in. Again, I'm not saying this is the job, but just to prove a point. But if you're able to sit back and think about the job, right? So the first thing, if you're a true undercover, okay, in my opinion, in the way that I do my investigations, everything should be audio and video. Everything that you do should be audio and video. So there is no question what happened during that transaction, during those conversations. So if you're doing that for 49 of your jobs, and the 50th you're doing it at a strip club, and you decided it's a strip club, I'm not gonna do video. Well, why not? Were you doing something you weren't supposed to? Now with that, all right, you're gonna do the job. Now it's gonna be video. You're at the strip club. What's normal? What would a normal person do at a strip club? Are you gonna be having ladies on you, men on you, whatever it is that you're into? So that's one to think about. The second thing, if you're going to a strip club and you're offered drugs, or you say you want to buy drugs, do people go to strip clubs to buy weight? If you're asking for drugs, what are you asking drugs for? What's the reason? Is it to say, hey, I want to buy these drugs so I could do it on Friday, or I could do it on Monday? If you're asking for drugs, it's because you're going to do drugs at the strip club.
Right.
Again, being able to sit back and understand what the norm is, what's normal. You know, hey, people get stopped by the police all the time. What's normal, right? You're always talking about reasonable articulable suspicion. What is normal? What would a reasonable person act? What's the way that they would act? It's the same thing in the undercover world. If you're doing that kind of a job, what would a reasonable person do? All right. When you're buying weight, let's just say, for example, you're buying cocaine, it's $40 a gram. If you're at a strip club on a Saturday night and you want to buy a ton of coke, how much do you think a $30 gram of coke that's in the inner city is going for at a strip club? $100? $150? $200 a gram? Would a normal person that's looking to buy weight, would they go into a strip club to buy? No. It doesn't make sense. So, again, I won't say my job, but just to put things into perspective, that to me is like my biggest oh shit moment, when I just would say yes to everything, and I didn't, at that point in my career, I wasn't able to sit back and say, all right, does this make sense? And it kind of ended where I could have put myself in position to get hurt, to blow the case, because I was so eager not only to prove myself, but I was drinking from a fire hose. I couldn't get enough of it. It was, you know, we go to the academy, we get out, and we see the narc guys, and like, oh my God, I'm going to do undercover. And then once you start it, like, all right, they're going to give me a car. They're going to give me money to go buy drugs. I wasn't a fucking drug dealer growing up. I could do this. My mother raised me to never play with guns and to stay away from drugs. I look at my mother now. What do I do for a living? I carry a gun and I buy drugs. So it's just, it's stuff like that. You know, it's funny, but it's truly amazing.
What do people get out of your class? Like when they come in and attend this training program, what is some of the feedback that you've received? How does it prepare them to go into this role of a narcotics detective?
So the first thing that I'll say is, again, I talk a lot, especially with you and even the street cop training staff. I talk a lot about my undercover role, but please understand that the class that I put out is not an undercover class. So what I do is I provide teaching points through my undercover videos. Again, you have guys like Kenny, Brad, Rob, right? Or even, you know, patrol guys, proactive guys. You'll get somebody that your seizures, your arrest, you're either going to get that person, for the most part, before they've done the drug deal, they're on the way to do the drug deal, or after they've done the drug deal. One or both guys will get. So with my class, what it provides you is that piece in the middle that's missing. Well, what happens during the drug deal? What's the hand-to-hand look like? What does that transaction look like? Is there a meeting before and then let's go do it? That's what my videos provide. So while you do get to see the undercover techniques that I use, how I do it, what I use, my tools, what it provides your patrol guys, interdiction guys, investigators, any kind of narc, is what it looks like when it's happening. So you have the indicators of what a drug deal looks like. So that's provided with patrol. And then we go into how, we basically go into what the investigation and how it starts. So what do I mean by that? There's actually a really good portion of another street cop instructor where he starts an investigation. He gives me a call and I show the students how it evolves from his motor vehicle stop, his seizure, all the way up until a takedown and even a Title III wire. It truly shows you how patrol and investigators can work together. And it all started with a motor vehicle stop. And it truly shows you how you can go from a motor vehicle stop using all the indicators that you've learned from, you know, Dennis, Rob, Scott Kivett, Brad, Kenny, all those indicators, you get your seizures, but then what? Do you just tag back, oh, let's go do it? Or do you take those extra steps to make one little phone call, and again, I show you what one little phone call from 50 bricks of heroin, because that's what it was. The seizure was, he saw all the indicators, makes the stop, gets 50 bricks of heroin.
Yeah, just tell everybody what a brick is, so that's a New Jersey term.
So a brick in New Jersey is 50 decks or 50 bags
of 0.1 grams of heroin in each bag, so it's 5 grams.
0.01,
yeah.
Or 0.02 grams in each bag, which amounts to one brick being 1 gram.
Okay.
So essentially, 1 kilo can make, in that math, 1,000 bricks.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm talking about. So 50, so essentially it was 50 grams of heroin. So
bundled up, ready to sell.
Correct. Packaged up.
It's a lot of heroin.
Yeah. So again, it's a street cop instructor. Again, I don't want to give it away, but it's a street cop instructor, makes the stop, sees all the indicators, makes the seizure, gives me a call. This is what I have. What do you think? I come out, I do a debrief of the informant. And again, I show how I go from that to implementing the informant to then it turning into an undercover to then making a seizure and it changing it to a Title III, all because one instructor decided to make a phone call. And it's truly, you know, mind blowing to see how your stops can go from It doesn't have to end right there. You can get that seizure and truly see how it can affect a drug trafficking organization. No seizure is too small. Oh, I only got 10 bricks of heroin. I only got 40 grams of coke. If it looks good, it can truly evolve to a huge investigation.
It's funny. I mean, how many times I've taken hunks of the kilo off of somebody, right? So you stop the car, you get your search, and you find a quarter key in the car, right? Just a hunk in a bag. I would say, would you think that's a good indicator that they probably have a larger connection?
Absolutely. And that's another thing that I go through in my classes. I start off the class saying, okay, how many guys or girls truly look at their seizures? If you got a quarter key, okay, and there's a picture that I show in my slides where, okay, tell me what you see here. And it's about 75 grams of coke. And I go through each student, okay, tell me what you see. And it's like, it's a seizure, it's coke. But what they don't realize, it's literally the corner.
Yeah, the corner of the bird.
Of a kilo.
Yeah.
Literally the corner. So there's heroin just above it, it's 100 grams, and then there's about 70 grams. And the coke is a corner. Right there and then, while, yes, the 100 grams of heroin, I'm jumping up and down, when you look at that corner key, that's telling you a story. Wherever this came from, there's more.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, there's more. So, again, it's not just, all right, yes, you did a great job. You saw the indicators. You took Den's class, Rob's class, all those guys. But now you did it. Go beyond that. Look at it. Okay, there's something else here. Let's make the right phone call. Let's get to the right resources to push this case forward. That's what I'm pushing in my class.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great blend between what the interdiction and proactive patrol guys are offering, and to kind of like, all right, you guys did it. What else can we do? Let's keep pushing it forward.
You know, for me, I'm somebody who's a student of constantly wanting education. If I was a cop who wanted more, there wouldn't be enough for me to take. I'd be taking these classes. There's a guy who works the next town over from me. I mean, I've seen him with 5 classes in the past like 4 months. He's driving all over to take the classes. And, you know, he's telling me, I'm having some major success. Of course you are. You're literally coming to the guys and girls who know how to do this shit and just getting your cheat sheet. You know, you're literally, and I find it amazing that people can't do the math on time. So they'll go out and want to learn it the hard way or the long way. And there's not many shortcuts in life, but there are some shortcuts in life. People say to me, how do you make such good business calls? How does Street Cop Training growing at the rapid rate that it is? Like, it's not just me. You know, I spend a lot of time in understanding business development and what's working, what's not, where things are evolving to, technology, social media. There is some natural gifts of mine, probably what made me successful, probably almost everything I've done. And I haven't done a lot of things, but if you follow the track record of my life, namely in employment, actually in my personal life, I was successful as a single man, right? I was constantly evolving, growing, and educating on how to get better at this. But there's a long way too, and that's by trial and error. You can go out and stop 1,000 cars and then learn A, or you could take class, but they'll waste that time. Oh, class is $200. Like $225, $250, $299. But bro, you're going to spend 2,000 hours trying to figure this out. Like, what is your time worth? Instead, at that time, you take those 2,000 hours and you could, instead of being a tier one, you could be a tier four, or you can be a tier six, depending on how many classes you take. And I'm comfortable telling people, like, I know you're going to be happy when you leave. Like, you know what I mean? I know you're going to be happy when you leave.
I've truly reached that level, and I'll be completely honest, I'm absolutely humbled, you know, to be a part of the Street Cop Training team. And I truly put everything I have, everything I can into my classes. And I always tell the students, say the word, whatever it is that you need, give me a call, send me an email. But I will say that it wasn't until my last class here in Fort Myers, you know, I've had students, hey, I drove an hour, 2 hours. And at my Fort Myers class, I had 2 students that drove 9.5 hours.
Wow.
Just to go to my class. And hearing that, like, if I could do a 16-hour class, like, I would, just to keep feeding these guys. Because when people are telling me that I'm driving 10 hours just to hear what you have to say, one, I love it. It's truly humbling.
They're committed, too.
Yeah, and it's just like, these guys are those guys that just teach me and I want to go. So that right there is what's huge. And I wish, could you imagine if every single, just think about this, every single cop in the United States was like that. I mean, I feel like it would be truly a different world here in the United States if we were all that hungry just to make a dent in that criminal world. You know, it's truly insane. And again, very humbled.
I had a guy sparked a memory of mine. My friend Craig said to me, because I worked with him for a long time, I had a lot of fun. He goes, if every cop here was a Dennis Bonino, this would be the safest town in the fucking United States. But they're not. And he meant it. You know, I did receive compliments like that. He's like, it was nice. I had a guy became a captain. He's a lieutenant, my friend Joe. I happened to see him after I was gone from the police department. We were talking outside of a place that I used to own. And he goes, and I never understood why people would say bad things about you. He goes, because I got to tell you, I was your shift commander. When I got promoted to lieutenant, I came over to your squad. And I wish I had 20 of you. I would 20 guys. I wish we were all you. He goes, and I would tell people, I'd defend you all the time. I go, the guy takes all the jobs. He writes a great report. He's a hell of a cop. He's tough. He knows how to drive. Like, he's like, if I had 20 Dennis Boninos on my shift, I'd be the happiest shift commander ever was. But yet I'd hear people talking shit about you all the time. I go, Joe, I've been trying to figure that out my whole life. And I get that I can rub people the wrong way until you get to know me a little bit. But once you knew me, why the animosity still? And I'm not a person who gets jealous of others or, so I have a hard time understanding that, dude. You know what I mean? Like, I don't get why people are dicks.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, listen, it was a great podcast episode. This will be the last time that Rios is on here, and appreciate you being here. Anything else you want to say to anybody before we go?
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate you guys. Truly, truly, in an unbiased way, best training that's out there, I'm telling you. I appreciate you guys. You guys are doing a great thing. And again, thank you for having me.
Guys, check out Rios' course, streetcop.com. You can find out where he's going to be next. And it's just worth it.